Thank you. Medical care, but guarantee anything. The chemo doesn't work with melanoma most times, almost never. The radiation doesn't work, almost never. Other cancers, yes. But so there was no value in pursuing those, which I wasn't going to do anyway. And then the consideration was doing another operation to take out the lymph, because cancer is in the lymph from the leg, from the drainage. And it also was confirmed that it doesn't guarantee any longevity, and the risks were tremendous, that it could just produce extra complications. Their concern is that the only treatments they really have for melanoma is operation. And sometimes they defer on it, but nothing to stink about that. So the idea is that you catch it early, and many people get it, especially in Australia, because of the sun. So they catch it early. So if I could catch it earlier, or in most cases you don't, then it's a death sentence. So basically they just showed me a chart of how long that one could expect to live, you know, based on the stage, and also based on, you know, past results of people who've had it. And so it really varied from months to years, and they thought it was something quite outstanding if you live for 5 years, if you have it. Of course, I'm just one before the last stage in terms of the stage as well as the depth. The depth, I'm over the charts. And the stage, I'm just one before the last stage. And so, you know, I had a chance to preach and to talk to them and to thank them. So my situation now is, like I said in one of the messages I sent out, I feel that I'm on borrowed time. I'm in a window now, you know, where things are going quite well. A couple of days back, I finished reading an interesting book by one of my godsisters, this is Mallabhar Kriti, who recently passed some months back of cancer. And I would advise you all to read it. I'm going to also send a message out to others that they should look at it. But it's mainly discussing the Prabhupada's life before he came to America. And it talks about so many people who Prabhupada met and who he impacted on. And it's quite awesome. My two best stories in there, she interviewed maybe about, you know, maybe 35 or 40 people. And these were pujaris and acharyas and people who Prabhupada had, you know, lived with, associated with in the Gaudiya Math, etc. And I thought the book was very, very informative and also very impacting. Because we here at North Prabhupada mainly, you know, we know a little bit about his history as a farmer's family. We know very little about his family. You know, one of his sons was retarded and became a homeless person, some of the other people. But we also don't know so much about how much he prepared himself, what the nature of his bhajan was before coming to America. And so there's some insight about that that's like overwhelming. And I'll tell you why I'm bringing this up in a minute. Two, I think, very astounding stories that completely affected my life or my life that's remaining. One was the pujari of the Advaita Acharya temple in India, where Advaita Acharya resided. And he talks about how there was this sadhu who used to come and just be in the back of the temple, you know, day after day for, I don't know, months or years. And he would just be in the back just chanting, you know, hours and hours and just crying. And because Prabhupada would sit in the back and would be very much into himself, Pujari said, he never talked to him, he never bothered him. He just felt that he didn't want to, disturb his bhajan. And then, after many years, maybe 15, 20 years later, a Western devotee happened to visit that temple, and that devotee had a BTG. And he gave it to the Pujari or showed it to him. And the Pujari saw this picture of Srila Prabhupada. And he recognized that this was the sadhu who he had been seeing. So then, of course, he got informed about what Prabhupada's activities had been since that time. And there's also Pujari who resided in the temple next to the Radha-Damodara Temple where Srila Prabhupada stayed. And he was interviewed. And so he was explaining to Mala Prakriti how he had never seen anyone with such intense bhajan. You know, there's all kinds of sadhus in Vrindavan. And he described what he had experienced. And he shared that for quite some time, he would hear this crying in the middle of the night. And he was often wondering who this was and what was this. So one day he got up on the roof of the house, I guess, next to the temple, and he looked down in the Radha-Damodara courtyard. And there, like in the middle of the night, was Srila Prabhupada sweeping the courtyard and just crying and talking out loud, praying to Rupa Goswami, some of the Goswamis, to prepare him and to allow him, equip him with the ability to carry out this service that was practically an impossible service, you know, that his guru had given him. So, and there were even many, you know, nice stories of that nature. How Prabhupada was living, you know, in such an impoverished environment, just a torn quilt. Anyway, when I read those stories, especially those two, I had a better understanding of just how important this movement is for the world, to what degree it was planned by higher arrangements, even more understanding how Prabhupada was like so connected with the Goswamis. How fortunate we are to be able, you know, to participate. And then even more, as we all know when we read the biography, how Prabhupada starts off with nothing, such an elderly age, and creates a worldwide mission. Well, that part we don't hear about much. Is it to the degree that Prabhupada went into his bhajan and crying and praying and going through austerity to do what was practically almost impossible, but knowing that the Goswamis and others, you know, would in fact use him. And there are more stories explaining about, you know, that reveals how much Prabhupada was in, you know, was in touch with the Goswami. So now what happened to me, you know, before I was asking devotees not to pray that I stay, and most devotees around the world, they were praying, you know, that I stay. And at some point, the nature of the disconference, I pretty much, you know, deferred to leave, figured that, okay, no problem. But now after reading that, in my own way, I prayed and communicated with Srila Prabhupada, and I asked him to give me another year or so. I felt so overwhelmed by this hearing and understanding better, a little bit more, about the degree of austerity, of dedication, of difficulties that he underwent even before, you know, coming to Radha-Damodara, and focusing on that, it helped me to feel that probably wherever you're going to take me to, or whatever you're going to do with me, I would like to have at least another year or so to be here with your mission here, and to make some very, very significant impact. So I feel in my own way that Prabhupada is granting me this. So my consideration is that I'm on borrowed time, and who knows, a year or maybe even more, maybe less, according to what he decides. But this is basically the situation now, is that the doctors are saying nothing else they can do. I've agreed not to go to any other allopathic operations or procedures. One thing they suggested that I visit NIH and do some experiment, but I visited there already before I went to Mexico, and I saw what they offer. And they basically deal with people who are casualties or near casualties, with the idea that they kill you from the experiment, it's okay because you have no other no means of survival anyway. So I feel that I'm under more than just the orthodox arrangements or karma, and that there's a divine intervention aspect, and so I don't feel like I need to go there as a last hope. So, I mean, no question that I'm not interested or eager, or a little bit of fear is there about a slow, you know, a painful cancer. that time, I'm going to try to literally travel all around the world, which will probably be a last world tour, which devotees will be very disturbed that I'm going to travel like this, but some of you. But I'll wait until I get prosthesis and a little more healthier. Since I've got to have a window, I'm going to use that as best as possible. I'm not thinking now about leaving my body in Vrindavan or Mayapur. Also, as I've been reflecting on Prabhupada's mood, and I was listening to several tapes by Tamal Krishna Maharaj, as he was Prabhupada's secretary in his last days. And he kept emphasizing that Prabhupada said he wanted to die in the battlefield. Of course, later we took him back to Mayapur. So I feel like that. My mood was always more, you know, eclectic and moving around and kind of communication and public relations and trying to help pious people in different communities and increase the faith of devotees, relate to help devotees and relate to help mature spiritual balance. And so my mood was, I think, was more of a mood that better that I die preaching in the field. So they were sending me some information about, you know, the samadhi and things, and if I leave my body in Mayapur. But I'm also going to communicate that, I'll move in the field. And if necessary, time permits itself, then I'll leave and get in my view. So let us look at today's discussion. I just finished a book 2 days ago on Die Before Dying. And I think it'll be a very important book. I think it's, you know, very likely going to be my last book. And I feel that this book was very good for me because I wrote this while going through the cure in Mexico and some Palm Springs and in Hawaii. Maybe I wrote one of them here in America. So I wrote them during the time I'm going through all of this, all the treatments, and literally just having to focus on past and possible immediate transcendence. So I felt this would be an interesting book of helping devotees to grasp more the concept of the Vaishnava leaving, to help me to become more focused and internal with my connection with Sadhu and Guru, Krishna, and also to be very honest about what I was feeling. And so I'm practically leaving the book in the order of how I wrote each prayer. It allows the reader to walk through as I'm going through such things. So I'm going to read Meditation 14. And the title of this is that the things we leave behind. So I started off earlier by saying, when we are going someplace, we are forced to think about what that environment entails, what's needed there. We try to equip ourselves what's necessary for functioning in that particular environment. Now, sometimes it's more difficult in thinking about what to leave behind. When you're packing, there's so many things in the closet. Difficult thing is what do you leave behind? You don't want to leave something behind that you may need. But also, there are times when you're forced to leave something behind. Then you have to regroup and think, what does that mean? Even once we were on the plane, I always think about this. I always carry a lot of important things in my briefcase. My briefcase, my bead bag, and because I have a prostate problem in the bathroom, they're probably three dominant things in my life, even before I get really sick. Is my bead bag, but then the toilet is when I go someplace, and also, you know, my briefcase, because I do my writings there, I keep my passports and ID and so many different things. So I would often think, when you first board the plane, they talk about, you know, buckle in, and they mention also, sometimes it's written down, if there is an emergency, leave your luggage behind. And sometimes I'm thinking, if that happens, well, I grab my briefcase anyway. Well, I should take something out of there. Let me take things out and put it in my pocket or whatever, in case something does happen. Then I think if something happens, would any of that make any difference anyway? People are going to grab stuff and not grab, and would it make a difference anyway? And so, it's somewhat analogous when we have to leave our particular body. Like you have to leave sometimes your children behind to do something. You have to leave your wife, you have to leave your husband, you have to leave your house. Some of you have been in an apartment or house, and you move. And then, you know, it's a trauma because it's like you got so adjusted to that space and that environment, and you're going to leave some of you there. So many things are like that. A job, you change jobs, whatever. Cars, so you got a new car, but you know, that car you had, it became a part of you, so much of integrated into your life, and you turn it in for a new car, but there's a part of you that's kind of dealing with some incoherence about leaving it behind. Some people don't, they just keep holding on to the same thing. Well, we know when death comes, we got to leave practically everything behind. And so that means our cars, our houses, our husbands, our wives, our children, our clothes, all the things that we thought we were, all the money we hid away. I mean, all of that just got to be left behind. And it's going to be the property and inheritance of somebody, the government or someone else. In most cases, they're not going to take it the same way that you took care of it. But in most cases, these things that we really identify with, which somehow, even though we are spiritualists, often we're still overly identifying, and we sometimes need to reflect on the fact that all of these things are so transitory, so temporary, and not only will we have to, but everyone must, at some point, be able to walk away. And so in the Mahabharata explains how Grandfather Bhishma explains, the only thing we really carry is dharma, that everything else turns away. Like when somebody leaves a body, whether they're cremated, whether they're put in the water, whether they are in a graveyard and put it, buried, whether they're put into a mountain and like the Parthians and eaten by the animal, whatever, is that people walk away from their body. And so you depart and they depart from you. And the things that we claimed or thought we owned, that they're no longer with us. But we do, of course, carry the karmic reactions. That's why I'm calling it die before dying, emphasizing that whether we die or not die, that we have to die. It's like Lobo had to give up the body. He had to give up the subtle body, the consciousness. Consciousness has to change in such a way. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, an ancient Vedic scripture, there's a section that describes the character and qualities of Prithu Maharaj. The section describes his very auspicious birth, and equates his various qualities to other great kings and other personalities who preceded him. His death is also simultaneously prophesied. See, sometimes these great beings, when they come into the world, you know, it's just like, again, we said how in the diplomatic corps, someone does something in one country and then they get transferred to some other place. Or like in the Brahmavarata Purana, it talks about Jesus. It explains interesting things about Jesus, about Buddha. Now, how does such scripture predict the coming of these personalities even before they appeared here? Description about Buddha talks about him even before he came into this world. So what happens is that sometimes this entity has already done something similar in a previous age, you know, a previous yuga, or sometimes a certain kind of service goes on, and a particular entity always takes that particular service. Like we know that Lord Brahma is not always the same entity, but it's a post. So certain posts of the demigods have a post, and so they do certain things each particular age. And therefore it can be discussed or written in the great scriptures because it has already happened before, because that is the nature of what goes on when one occupies that particular post. So here in the case of Prithu Maharaj, his life was being compared, he was being compared to other great rishis and sages and kings. He was glorified like anything by his quality as a perfect ruler. And at the same time, even the way he would die and what that would entail was also given. When one meets death, one must leave behind so many possessions, associates, and other attachments. However, one who understands the inevitability of death and eternality of the soul. And, of course, who has fully surrendered to the Lord's arrangement will not be disturbed about what is left behind. Parents make so many sacrifices for their children. Most would sacrifice their own life for their children. Most of you have children. You would be willing to sacrifice your own life. When the children start school, when they go to college, when they move out, when they get married, one will have to accept separation. Some of you have had that experience where your son or daughter finally goes to school and the kid cries when they first go and you go home and you cry also. Or, you know, your daughter or your son, you know, finally gets married and you're happy like anything. Finally, you know, she's out of your hair. And now somebody has taken her to take care of her. But then you look at a picture sometimes in the house and you start crying. Oh, my honey, she's gone. So you are happy in one sense that they are matured, they're going on with their life, they've accepted a certain level of maturation and now even perhaps pursuing a family. But at the same time, you feel a tremendous loss. And the person is still alive, of course. We see that we feel a loss when there is this abrupt, you know, kind of change. Normally the parents see the children as their property, an extension of themselves. One obviously wants to stay in control of their property. But when death comes to the parent or child, the forced separation must be honored. However, one who understands the inevitability of death, the eternality of the soul, and who has fully surrendered the Lord's arrangements will not be disturbed about what is left behind. It is natural for each living entity to desire to seek out a special partner. Many feel one day they will in fact meet their soulmate. We are made for love and we are starving for love. However, what we normally consider love is lust, i.e. the fulfillment of our own egocentric selfish desires. Many people spend their entire life looking for, waiting for that special person to descend in their lives. Most keep thinking he or she has finally arrived just to later become more and more disappointed. A few who do seem to find that special lover becomes even more upset, sad, and disappointed when he or she dies. The more wonderful the connection, the more painful the permanent separation is. You can see the nature of the sambandha relationships in the two worlds. That either way, they're going to bring some pain. You're going to bring some pain that you're looking for that person who somehow didn't quite find you, and there's a problem. Or you find someone who, basically, the chemistry works very well, physically, psychologically, and spiritually, in some cases. And often that can be even more devastating because of the synchronicity and where you complement each other, and then when you're not together, it can be very difficult. Unless, however, one who understands the inevitability of death, the eternality of the soul, and who has fully surrendered the Lord's arrangements, will not be disturbed about what is left behind. Most people spend the majority of their quality hours working on their jobs. You see, the reason I wrote this, Beggar, the mentality I was in, accepting that death was very near, and I was this doing an inventory on what will I leave behind. And it allowed me to look, you know, very close at the different faces and activities of different God brothers and God sisters, different services, disciples, projects. And so I had to, like, process all of that and accept that, okay, so I had a chance and a time to be active in different environments, to associate with different great souls, and to try to be involved in creating and developing certain things. And now the results or the effort has been put out, and now the, you know, grading or the testing or the final report, you know, is about time to come in. The disciple has to constantly think that he has an obligation to his spiritual master. And so, although one may be a so-called guru or spiritual master, him or herself, but one is that the degree that one of things what I need to maybe give a little more attention to, knowing that I'll leave it behind? What things I need to get rid of even faster, knowing that, you know, I'm going to leave it behind? And of course, this is everyone's situation, is that we're going to have to leave a whole lot of things, practically everything, even who we thought we were behind. And I was realizing also, I'm going to leave John Favors, Jana Sham, Swami Krishna Pad, Bhakti Theater, Guru Dev, Maharaj, I'm going to leave all that behind. Because I'm none of those things. Any more than any of you, or what you normally consider you are, or how people relate to you, that we have an identity that's like, in many cases, totally different from what we have thought we are and what other people have, how they perceive us. Now, the more that we accelerate in our spiritual consciousness, more we become aware of who we are, whether we're acting on that level in the physical on a day-to-day basis. No, not, of course. But one becomes more and more aware, because as one becomes more spiritual, then there's less barrier between the body, the mind, and the soul. And so the individual begins to live on several levels at the same time. I was speaking to one of my godfathers the other day, Shivram Swami, and it was in a kind of a crossroad period. And I was mentioning that there's times when I feel more eager to drop this present identity. And I was saying in summary that somehow Prabhupada has blessed me that I have, you know, have a little bit of acquaintance of other aspects of my existence. But I said, but I'm afraid to do that because that may take me out faster. In other words, if you are in one apartment, you know you're gonna move in 6 months, but in 2 months' time, you start doing everything related to the other apartment. It's almost like you have already gone. You know, so the nature of my situation is so delicate and whatnot, and my own psycho-spiritual makeup is extreme. So then I'm the kind of entity that may, you know, leave in 3 days abruptly, or stay for 30 or for, you know, 15, 30 years. Even. Now that is not so likely, but again, extreme. So what happens then is that as we become less and less attached to the present duality, present material situations, if it's relativity and transitory, then what's left for all of us is who we really are. We're all pure in our original Swarup, original nature. And what we are experiencing now is acculturation. So when we stop holding on to things that we have accumulated with full identification, then what comes forth is our natural beauty, natural quality of the soul, such as Nandavigraha. So in one sense, stabilization is not as difficult as we sometimes think. Difficult because we're so conditioned. Prabhupada explains the conscious in a very simple way, and it was wonderful because it's very complicated. But it's very complicated and even more difficult than we normally think. We don't tell people in Bhakti 101 class that the longer you are a devotee, the more you're going to be challenged, and the more difficult your challenges are going to become. So thank you for joining Krishna Consciousness. The longer you are a devotee, the more you're going to be challenged. And you want to get first initiation? No problem. Little challenge. Second initiation? Going? More challenges. And the more you chant Hare Krishna, the more you become serious, greater challenges. Welcome. Not so many people would be eager for that. So as we go on in our Krishna consciousness, it becomes more difficult, but not necessarily harder. Most things it becomes both. More difficult, yes, it must be. What you study in secondary school and what you study in high school and in college, what you study in college is more difficult than what you study in primary or secondary school. You expect that. But if your preparation, your background and training was sufficient, then even though you have a more difficult studies and more is called up, you're called upon more for a higher level of performance, it's okay. Because it's expected that you have the skills and you have the background to be able to excel. So yes, as we go on, it is more difficult. And that's what a lot of people years ago that were okay 5 years ago, but are not sufficient now 10, 15 years later. The nature of the environment has changed. The nature of what you are subjected to has changed. And what's expected of us also has changed. So someone, that's why sometimes it's shocking that somebody did so good for 10 years, and then somehow or other they become, they've changed so much, or they fell down. Well, if we're not constantly growing, and if our also, if our foundation was not sufficiently strong enough, later in our devotional life, it will come out, and it will hurt. Sometimes devotees start up. This is why, you know, when you first come to devotional service, when others come, it's very important to try to get them into good habits. And it's very important to get them into as best understanding as possible, because then that is the foundation that they're going to build upon. If it's not sufficiently strong, they may get away with that weak foundation at first, and later it's going to be very difficult. Sometimes you see people in high place and they're falling down. If you go back and look at their foundation, and you'll see there were weaknesses in the foundation. And usually it comes along with aparas that begin, you know, to develop at a later time. So Krishna consciousness is very organic, and it's very monitored. It's like no cheating. When you cheat, it's marked under your name. And you're going to get some difficulties and some, you know, debits based on that cheating. Now, the beauty of that is that everything is being observed by the Lord in the heart. And so when you do something good, even though it may not be accepted, recognized, understood, but if it's actually, you know, with good intention is proper, that's also marked. And that becomes a part of your permanent bank account. Now, as we are doing different things year after year, our bank accounts are growing or we're taking away. And at certain points in our life, we have chance to draw off that bank account. That's why sometimes a person is doing well and they start drawing and everything is totally gone. You begin to wonder, these bodies, like they're drying up. What do you do when you've had something and you keep taking and taking out? One day you look and you're overdrawn. Now what also happens when you've been putting in and putting in, for a long period, it seems like nothing has happened. When you're putting in investments, you know, in one sense, it seems like everything is the same. But then one day, you know, you get the mutual funds, you get the stocks, or you cash in on the money market, whatever, and you have all of this that all of a sudden is made available for you that's yours. So we want to do, like when the sage was telling the Brahmacharya, you can live, the devotee, you can live or die. Meaning that even now your situation is quite austere, but what's waiting for you is wonderful. You're austere, and what you're having is great realizations based on the environment, and when you leave, you're going to have similar. So in each case, and then he told the butcher, you die, because you live as long as you can, because when you die, you're going to suffer so much, because you got so many debits. Yeah, and you can live as long as you can, because you may be enjoying now. He's telling my friend, you got certain benefits and assets that has to do with something from the past and some mercy perhaps, but you have done a lot of stuff, and it's going to be different. So, this is where to try out faith and patience becomes very important. What Goswami explains, the importance of determination and faith, perseverance. And if we are doing the right thing, we have to do it understanding this is my offering to Guru. How would Guru feel watching me right now when I'm doing planning? And then we'll be more, let's say, productive in what we are depositing and whatnot. In today's society, let me do a little more. Often one thinks that instead of leaving a job, one thinks he or she is the job. Instead of having a job, one thinks that they are the job. One may have studied very hard to become competent in their profession, made many Herculean sacrifices, passed many tests, and had outstanding achievements. However, at some point in the near future, when death comes, the job and all those things associated with it will also be left behind. So we have to realize that we have a job and not think that we are that, because we're going to have to walk away from that. And the way society is now in the Western world, you can work really hard and get to the point of almost near retirement, everything they were supposed to. Went to university, got a good education, got a good job, worked very hard in the company, and they're in their late 40s or 50s at a time when they're almost ready to retire, too old to start a new profession, too young to retire, and they're in big difficulty. And they get sacked or they change, and someone younger comes in, and they feel completely cheated. Or some of these companies, when pension time comes, if money's not there. Anyway, many disappointments. And I'm seeing it now because I'm just recently I got insurance. And I'm just shocked to hear some of the stories that people undergo with the insurance company. Is that all different kind of insurances, and some cover this and cover that, and in many cases they try to find natural ways, of course, how not to compensate you. And you have all these people who have been paying insurance all their lives, and they get really ill. In some cases, it doesn't cover certain things. In today's society, it is important to have a functional, secure residence. The mortgage payments, repairs, taxes, and other maintenance of one's house can be extremely demanding. Some of you know that. The bigger house you got, the more it eats you up. More for cleaning, more for mortgage, and more for repairs. It's like the house becomes an entity. It's just demanding. All right, fix the plumbing. Okay, do painting. Okay, repair this, repair that. Pay the mortgage, pay the taxes. The larger, more opulent the house, the more care and attention are demanded from the owners. The owner furnishes and decorates the house and cleans it on a regular basis. The apartment, house, or mansion is like a very greedy, demanding living entity that is never satisfied and is always asking or wanting for service. Even though the owner has given such special care and touches to their residence, and has spent decades acquiring so many things to decorate the house, when death comes, they will have to permanently separate from their residence. Sometimes houses become haunted because people just have such trouble, even though the physical body goes, they just can't leave, that environment. However, one who understands the inevitability of death, the eternality of the soul, and who is fully surrendered to the Lord's arrangements will not be disturbed about what is left behind. One or two more paragraphs. There are others who give more attention to decorating their bodies. They have closets full of clothes and drawers full of jewelry, cosmetics, and other things. That doesn't fit devotees so much, huh? Well, I don't know. But it's okay. Have you ever seen a gopi who wasn't very attractive? Have you? You ever seen a gopa who wasn't very suave, huh? So, those people who think Christian, think spiritual life is something very boring and dry, they're missing the truth. Is that in our original bodies, they're very talented and very artistic and very attractive and flamboyant. In today's society, there are others who give attention to their decorating their bodies. Some people keep up with the latest styles, love to shop, love others to be envious of what they wear. Some are not only excessively into what they put on their bodies, but what they do to their bodies as well. Not even children are getting plastic surgery. They may go on many diets. I was saying the other day, yesterday I checked my weight. I was 142 pounds, so I've lost over 40 pounds. I was saying I should write a book on how to lose 40 pounds in 2.5 months. I'm trying to gain, I'm trying to lose. Some people get anything. They can lose 40 pounds in 2 months, in 3 months. Huh? Some people would love to gain it. They may go on many diets, exercise religiously, and others may visit the plastic surgeons regularly for various modifications and adjustments. However, no matter how much they decorate and modify the body, the end result is massive deterioration to one's health. The end result of whatever we do for our body is ultimately the same, is that we do need that. However, one who understands the inevitability of death, the eternality of the soul, and who is fully surrendered to the Lord's arrangements will not be disturbed about what is left behind. The hardest attachment to leave behind is often wealth and close friends. because family is very special also. They are somewhat similar. Let's look at this for a moment as we come to our conclusion. We identify ourselves by our possessions, especially our finances. Today's society, people are very much categorized by their finances. You live in a certain place based on your finances, often you go a certain place, you eat a certain way, you do certain things, have certain extracurricular things, you know, based on finances. And often you have certain associates based on finance. People at a certain level have a tendency to associate with each other. We feel secure or very insecure according to our financial status. Our monies and financial assets are connected with the confidential aspect of our lives. Just as we share so many confidential things with our closest friends, and they with us. Just as when one is facing various difficulties, there will be some significant solace when one remembers he has stocks, bonds, gold, diamonds, real estate saved away that can't be accessed when needed. You know, when you get these kind of things, there's a part of you that's feeling a certain amount of solace. You're thinking, well, I have a little trouble now, but I got 100,000 in stocks, you know. I can pull off of it when necessary. I am struggling right now, but, you know, I have 3 or 4 buildings in real estate. Close friends serve the same purpose. They are very magnanimous. I'm sorry. They are very magnanimously on reserve, waiting and available to assist in any way that they can. It is very hard for most, and this is just a real close friend, eager to be available, just waiting for an opportunity. It is very hard for most people to appreciate existence without both of these confidants. However, sometime in the near future, when death calls, we will all have to leave behind the highly valued support, securities, and also intimate friends. And we conclude, however, one who understands the inevitability of death, the eternality of the soul, who has fully surrendered the Lord's arrangements, will not be disturbed by what is left behind. I am that lowly beggar who will also die in the near future, who will leave possession, associates, attachments, and many relationships behind. Your prayers have prepared me to not be disturbed by what I left behind. For I will take your prayers and love with me. So as I said, I wrote this whole book while reflecting on life, reflecting on death, reflecting on eternality. And so in this early prayer, number 14, it must be maybe 21, 22 prayers. So almost halfway before the book was over. And I was particularly looking a little closer at the past, addressing, of course, the present, but realizing the present is just the near future. And looking at in the future, what exactly would I be leaving behind? And of course, I realized, you know, everything in terms of the physical things, and of course, many relationships in some way, but at the same time, the spiritual relationships go on. They have their way to go on. Connection with disciples, vows are made on my side and their side. Connection with myself as a disciple, vows are made, you know, with my guru. And of course, in my case, and I've written so many books, so, you know, that'll hang around for a while. I have 4 or 5 that'll be coming out, you know, this year. And some impressions in some seminars, workshops, some impressions about the kind of mood and service that I offer. That we all bring something, you know, into the movement. And then looking at things that I would leave behind. And so it was my way of trying to die before dying. It was another way for me to try to be appreciative and grateful for what I did have and what I who I did associate with, and a way to kind of try to honor those relationships, and even more so, to try to see how to maximize the opportunities and chances to have quality association where there is still some time in such ways. And that's why I said my idea, and this can change according to what happens and how fast cancer may come back or spread. faith, because when you're struggling and you're suffering, it often causes one to lose the ability to remain very focused. Like when you're in pain, you can do one thing or the other. It can cause you to become more internal, it can cause you to become anxious and angry and irritable, etc., etc. So unfortunately, most people, when they are dealing with their extreme challenges, it often goes into another mode. Instead of focusing that intensity at the lotus feet of the divine couple, often the tendency gets focused on why me, or on others, or scapegoating, or whatever. So I, of course, just felt Krishna has been so kind to me, you know, and that I need to pay back. So I feel that a major part of what I'm going through is part of a chance to try to be more of a servant. And already I see just literally dozens of devotees, especially who are undergoing different challenges, chronic illnesses and things, write me and call me, have already told me how they've been helped so much by this drama that I'm going through. A tremendous number of leaders calling me. It's really sharing on a level like never before. So let me stop there. Let's see if we have a few questions. What we leave behind. Now, once you look at their own life, my concern of writing and sharing these is not just to share something I've written, what's the value of that, but literally for my own self-edification and purification, as well as for you to reflect and put it in your own life and look at to what degree are you excessive about something that you're holding on to what degree you need to get something fixed before you leave the body, what things you need to prioritize more, what areas you need to minimize that you're giving too much attention to, given that you're going to have to leave it behind, and what kind of relationships you need to strengthen when you do leave that person or those persons behind, that you won't feel that there was things that you didn't have chance to do that really should have been done. Some of the saddest people when death comes are those who didn't bring closure. So they're thinking, I really didn't tell them I loved them, I should have apologized, I should have went there and did this, did that. So they're crying over the cast or whatever, but really it's kind of self-pity that this person has left, or left them behind. How could they do this? It's anger. But we've looked at all of that, and then when time comes, then there's no problem. So any questions? And I started off by saying what? I started off, so today we talked about in 45-second summary. I discussed first that I'm going to send out a message basically saying, asking the devotees if they can take my picture off the altar. There's no immediate death right now, from what seems to be the case. Asking to continue praying, that I have made a submission to Srila Prabhupada after particularly looking and reading this book by Mala Prakriti. I've just seen how much more involved Prabhupada was in preparing for this mission, how much he suffered, seemingly, or sacrificed in trying to get the full grace and blessings to do this, and in realizing that how Prabhupada is going on eternally in Krishna's service, and how many people who are with him now, people who've been with him in previous lives, and when they leave, they will be commissioned with him, or arrange things, will be things rearranged, by his mercy. So my concern was, previously, no problem, if I leave today, tomorrow, or left earlier, okay, just allow whatever is best for my guru's service. And still that is the consciousness, but I am putting in the additional aspect, is that I see it even better, more, how intense you prepared yourself, and I would like, if it's okay with you, to be able to have another year to try to add something to what you've given, to kind of do whatever I can to help make it a little more secure, or to help some edges, round off some edges and whatnot. And hopefully the devotees will tolerate me. They may think, I thought you were going, Swami. You're more outrageous than ever before. Now I'll just tell them, a man raising from the grave cannot be controlled. Have nothing to lose. That have to go for it, you know. In this way. So, tell him, well, it's your fault, it's great that I stay. So, I mean, that's my plan, but who knows, you know, maybe I may not be so fit for traveling between places. But we'll see. And then I read, of course, the prayers, the meditation on the what we leave behind. So we looked at even the basic things, you know, we travel, we have to prepare. But let's say we're going to make the big travel out of this body. We do have to look at what's needed, what that environment is. See, that's where the study of the scripture becomes very important. And especially where we're looking at the dynamics of the devotees, is that as you're going somewhere, you have to look at what that environment is. So we read more in the scriptures about what is the environment of the spiritual world and how the activities of the pure devotees, then we can be more astute about adjusting our lives that we'll be able to, you know, see fit in. So, any short questions or comments? Took longer than I anticipated, so forgive me. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maharaj, since you mentioned you're talking about death, since we never know exactly when we're going to die, how can one feel a sense of closure, a sense of success, at the same time knowing that we could die at any moment? In terms of on a practical day-to-day basis, sometimes self-work involves some of the modes of passion, and so that kind of activity gives the feel of always hankering for something. But what we could you elaborate more on the technology of feeling that sense of closure by, like you said, understanding we didn't have an earlier death and so on?
Yes, we shouldn't accept the mode of ignorance and passion. I remember several years ago in Nigeria, there was an evangelist who had convinced so much of the country that the world was going to end, like in about 2 months. And so people got all the money out of the bank. Some people just started going to visit prostitutes with the little money they had. Some people just started traveling. Some people just didn't pay their bills. I mean, all kinds of things. And then days before time, that last day, the guy just disappeared. And he had got so much money and things from other people. So anyway, it's an extreme case. So one shouldn't consider, or like with the Y2K, huh? Some people just didn't pay their bills. And when Y2K didn't happen, they were totally anxiety. You know, they were feeling, oh my God, everything's gone on as usual, practically. The idea is to just look closer, you know, the idea of first things first, or looking at priorities. Looking a lot closer at what is our real essential primary things that are our identity, what are those things that are sanatana, that are eternal, that we want to try to continue to connect with, while we take care of the body and the mind. It's not that because the house or the car is temporary that we deny it. It's that we do even better. We try to expertly and efficiently and expediently take care of it, so we have less energy to have to put into that, or we can put more energy into something else. But if we don't take good care of it, we have to put more time into it, and we have to disperse our energies in so many ways, we miss the chance to give more time to that, you know, that is primary. And that's why a devotee should always try to be the best in whatever they do. So you're going to be an engineer, you're going to be a doctor, carpenter, a painter, or whatever. You're going to be the sweep floors. You do it as best you can, because that's an offering to Krishna. And to see it as that. But also, as you do that well, is that success, excellence, and integrity just extends itself in all aspects of one's life. You really can't, and Anuttama and Seksha discuss these things about ethics, you can't, like, have such a due standard of ethics. You can't, like, be so-called a sadhu while you jump over dharma. And you think, oh, these things are not important. This is just secular. This is just something that's relative. No. But as you do that, that's you. You're the same person. Or it's like the thing where your private and personal life, you have a different, you know, different standard of morality. No, it's the same person. So this way, what we're doing, what other things that we do, we should do them as an offering to Krishna. But constantly look at what is really essential, you know, to your spiritual life, to make sure that that isn't being jeopardized. Other questions?
Maharaj,
going to funeral home. I remember being very small and just looking at the at the writing of the person, and then the person in the casket, and the daddy would say, "Oh, he's so young, he died already." And this one is, seems to have a nice smile, you know. But one of the things that stuck on my mind is that the, I guess you call them the morticians, they often can know something about a person by how the body looks when it comes in. And some people, they have such fear on their face, you know, because they've seen the Yamadutas. And some pious people, they leave, you know, like with a smile, seemingly very pleasant. So sometimes they can know something about the individual by looking at the you know, the physiognomy, of course, the face tells a lot about the mind. So, to answer your question more directly, is that since death is really the accumulation or the aggregate of life, so therefore, it's not really that at death now we can just somehow, you know, just click. I mean, mercy is there. Prasad is very important. And mercy is even greater than Krishna's law. But basically, according to how we live day to day, all is now part of, again, like the bank account. And then that what accelerates the soul. So if we have lived a very insensitive life, or very much focused on materialism and made that our priority, we have so much put Krishna, work him in an extracurricular way, then when we come near death, we're going to be in so much anxiety about what people are going to do with our house and how this is going to, these bills are going to be paid and what's going to happen to this person or that person. Yes, some reflection should be there, but as one gets ready into the last moments or hours or days on this planet, you've got to drop all of that. And that's really hard. How hard it is for a parent to really drop that attachment to the children. It means that you got to think of them, but you got to think of them as like, Krishna gave me these souls to take care of. And the same Krishna is responsible for seeing that these souls get the next kind of care that they need. If I've done what I was supposed to do necessary, then I've set the arrangement for that. But if you're thinking, I got to be with this kid because I got to make sure that, you know, they get off drugs. All right, another body. Another chance. Anything that becomes more important than our willingness to join in the spiritual kingdom means more time to work that out. And that's what's kind of difficult. And that's what's confusing. That's what's dangerous. Because when we hear no love in the material world, we hear we should not be attached, then we often are excessive with that. And we act impersonally, or we avoid attachments. Because Kapilya Dev explained to Devahuti is that one must be attached. Sadhya Vaishnav saving their body and take care. One must be attached to lotus feet of devotee. So it's not that we're trying to have a lifestyle based on detachment of that which will assist in our devotion. Nibbana Krishna Sambandha Devaki, that we are to be really attached to that which brings us back to the kingdom of God. And so in this way, we take the best care of our wives, the best care of our children, the best care of our cars, our house, in the sense that the real owner is Krishna. And therefore, because the real owner is Krishna, we must take better care than even if it was ours. In this way, we are involved with attachment and care, but at the same time, we are detached sufficiently with a personal proprietorship. So when death comes, it's just the announcement of what has been going on. And now, you know, the bank statement shows. Like that. And then the person says, well, my bank statement's like this. What can I do now to make a difference? Well, you got to look at what you've been doing alone. You've been drawing out, or you weren't depositing. So this is what's happening. You can't think, well, the bank statement is going to come tomorrow. Now, what can I do? Well, you've already done it. Last couple of months, weeks, or last couple of weeks, you've been taking a whole lot out. And so what you're going to see is, you know, what the result of that is. And when you've been putting in, you think, what can I do? Well, it's wonderful. And you're going to see in the next day or two what you have. Based on the actual deposit. going to just do whatever I have to do. And then the last, you know, when I know I'm going to get ill or die, then I'm going to become serious. See, like in my case, in one sense, I'm very fortunate of knowing, you know, that the death is soon. It's there. And so, it's like in the case of Maurice Pritchett, in the 7 days, you say, oh, terrible to die in 7 days. But how fortunate he was. Because he was clear that he's out in 7 days. So even though I'm going through all of this, I mean, you know, I think the situation has been so hellish that in the last couple of months, I haven't slept. It's the last 2 days I've begun to have some quality sleep. I mean, just something simple like that people just take for granted. Take for granted laying down and going to sleep. Now, I have a better understanding of what people go through, you know, when they have insomnia, and I feel so sorry for them. First, I couldn't sleep because the cancer was so intense in the foot that every 15 minutes, it would just, the leg would just shake. And then somehow the tablets I was, whatever was going on, was accelerating my prostate problem. And so either the leg was shaking, or I had to wake up every 45 minutes, hour, you know, to pass urine. And so that was the problem. And that went on, you know, for weeks and weeks, or well, maybe 2 months, a month and a half. And then once the leg was, the amputation that took place, the body had gotten so much in the habit of not sleeping that it's taking a while for me to just be able to learn how to sleep again. You know? So yesterday, I was like in bliss that I had slept, you know, more than 2 hours, you know. And this morning, I was like in bliss. Because what I would do is every time I wake up, I look at the clock and I think, oh my God, only 45 minutes. And so to be tired and not to be able to sleep is hell. You know, I'm going to say all the other things. But just to think of that, you realize, oh, wow. So this is also one of the reasons I was, you know, not disturbed about leaving. When you get, you know, cancer that's there, that's like a death sentence. You got sugar diabetes, the change, you know, everyone knows how much I like to have sweets. I wouldn't eat a meal without sweets. Huh? I mean, literally, those who cook me, they know. If you brought me some pasala, and there was no sweet there, I would send the plate back and or I would wait until the sweet comes. And not only that, I eat the sweet with the food. I mean, it's just kind of a, you know, Gujarati style eating something sweet. I mean, Gujarati my last night. But I couldn't enjoy the food unless I have a sweet. I'm eating the sweet along with the food. And all of a sudden, I got this diet, you know, where there's no sugar and no this and no that. And even worse, the first couple of months, I was no grain and no protein. I mean, the protocol they gave me in Mexico was to starve the cancer. And it was starving me also. You know? And that's how I lost a lot of the weight. Is that it was just fruits and vegetables and very bland and no grain and probably no protein. And so the idea was going to starve this cancer. Well, the treatment's from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. But then also, you're starving yourself. So to think of, you know, sugar diabetes and insomnia and high blood pressure and prostate problems and cancer, all those things, at the same time, to see that as mercy, you know? So everything has to do with consciousness and how we codify and how we perceive something. I mean, if you had asked me a year ago, what were two things I would least want to see happen to me? That is not to be able to travel, not to be able to dance. These are the things that I have on me right now. Now I'm going to get around it. I'm going to travel on it soon. I told the doctor 2 days ago, I said, you got to make a prosthesis for me that I can dance in. So I may not have long to dance, but I want to dance. And so, you know, they gave me measurements, and you know, they'll try. We'll see. Yes. This will be our last question. Well, you ask those who are my caretakers, they'll tell you that it's difficult to deal with me. They'll tell you, you know, even once, this is on the side though, you know, I had to have a few blood transfusions. And one blood transfusion I got, I just got ridiculous. I mean, I was just joking about everything. And I was out of character, and I realized, whoever whoever gave me this blood. Whoever's blood belongs to must have been a comedian. I mean, you know, I can bear about to just tell you, I was in the hospital. You know, they gave me, in a month past time, I had 3 blood transfusions. And one of them, you know, every time I was a little shift. But one, afterwards, I just laughed at everything. And just, and just tried to share everything in a funny way, you know. And I thought, this is out of character. I mean, I do that sometimes, but I mean, the nurses come in and they were serious. And I even told one nurse, you wouldn't believe this. He came in to poke me, you know. They were checking my blood sugar. And then they had to take some blood to do some evaluation. And I just looked at her and I told her, how would you feel? What would it be like? Every time you had to visit a patient, in order for you to see them, they had to poke you. I just started bursting out laughing. Yeah, I was in the bed with all these tubes in me and everything, you know. And she comes in, I'm trying to see my vital signs. And I just look at her and tell her, you know, how would you feel? Every room you go to, they say, come. She looked at me like I was crazy. But, you know, how get them, yeah. But just to mention all these things. Now, the point is, I don't know. I wouldn't have expected 2 years ago that I would be ready to accept this. I mean, I can see why comics commit suicide. By having so much inconvenience, so much pain, so much shift in their life. And when they have that and see the future is only more of that, you know. Now, to be a devotee, we know that we don't do suicide. And everything has its purpose and its, you know, and its time. And to be put into a situation where you become an invalid, where you're used to being very independent and, you know, spontaneous. So it's like a total shift. I would normally have trouble even staying in a place a couple of weeks. I feel that I should be doing something different. I mean, even to the point that for most of my devotional life, I very conscientiously did not sleep up to 6 hours. And if I slept 6 hours, I would feel, this is time that belongs to my guru and also to the devotees. So I should use that time the best that I can. Now, I'm at a point where I'm thinking, only if I can sleep 6 hours. You see, so it's like a total shift. Most of my life as a devotee, I eat only once a day. Now I should get diabetes, but I must eat several times. And they're pushing me, I'm still eating twice, but instead of eating 3 times. So it's like everything is shifting in that way. So my point is, I don't think that I could do this. So I'm feeling that I'm able to do it because there's mercy from devotees' prayers. I'm able to do this because I feel that Srila Prabhupada has personally put me in a situation, you know, to use me for something bigger. I feel that the ultimate outcome of this will assist in touching the heart chakra, you know, of the institution somewhat, opening it up more. I feel there's certain things I've tried to address. When I'm gone, will even have, you know, a greater impact than when I'm here. You know, that's unfortunate. So, therefore, when I look at all of that, and I think, you know, it's actually worth it. When I get the calls from my godbrothers, there's so many of them, and we share, and I hear how they're being impacted upon based on what I'm going through, when I consider that kind of the first time in our history that someone's picture been on all these kind of altars for such a long time. Symbols all around the world, my picture's there. They've been praying for me. And I think, well, the situation is so gross. The Christians give me so much extra help and extra prayers to make this transition. And challenges, and those who know me know that I'm very spoiled, you know. I was a baby in the family. My mother spoiled me. I had four sisters and two brothers who, you know, spoiled me. My teacher spoiled me. I was a pet most of the time. Prabhupada spoiled me in so many ways, you know. If you look at some of the letters he wrote me, you'll see he spoiled me in so many ways. And now I got disciples who spoiled me. And I was the kind of person who had never really got sick in my life, except when I had the prostate issue. And someone who was very afraid of pain. And then to have to deal with all of that, total shift. I don't see myself being responsible for the strength to deal with it. I feel that. Because sometimes, to be honest, I'm shocked myself to realize in the condition that I'm in and how I should be more disturbed. You know, I mean, when they tell me that, yesterday when I spoke with the doctor, we spoke for quite a while. I just told him, look, the doctor, I'm not afraid of dying. He said, let me know exactly what can you offer. And he was honest. He said, really, he said, that operation can't guarantee you, you know, a day more of life. He said, the interferon, he said, some tests say that it helps. He said, but more tests show that it doesn't make a difference. He said, normally we would give you our treatment for melanoma is operation interferon. And so he was letting me know that what we have, we can't guarantee you anything. He said, what we can show you is, in general, a graph of how long people expect to live, you know, based on what you have. And I just thanked him, and I just thanked the whole staff, and some of them were kind of amazed. This guy just found out that we can't do anything, you know, and he's thanking us. But I was glad they were honest, and I knew that already since then. So, you know, I mean, how I can do that and all the plans I had. See, my chart, for instance, my astrological chart, and some devotees told me that my chart, shows that my life just begins to start this year. Is that I'm an entity of the future, so to speak. That this year, up until 80, is when there's one achievement after another on a huge international level with governments and people and influence of land and communities. So it's like from my normal situation of this body and this coming into this soul coming into this body, is that my life is just beginning to start now in terms of my impact, you know, my devotional impact, you know, in my service to my guru. Now whether Prabhupada made this change, this whole thing around, and just shock everybody, and the cancer goes, and I go on, possibility, but not so likely. More than likely is that in order at this point, based on what's necessary in my prayers, greater impact is I need the body. That may change. But so in one sense, it's like even that has all shifted. But then if we're doing things for Guru and Krishna service, then it's up to them how they use it. You're giving something to put someone else and they use it this way or that way, all right, it's up to them. If you're really giving it to them. If you're not giving it to them really, then you want, it's got to be used like this. Because you want to be controlling it because you're still claiming proprietorship. But you're feeling, no. You have to use this only like this. And if that's the case, then that's, you know, that's attachment. So my point is, when I did that first MRI, and they put me under that machine, and I was, you know, it was a long, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour. And I did two things. One, I just did mental bhajan of just thinking of different leaders being in Mayapur at the DDC meeting and just reflecting on all the good qualities of these leaders and their service to Prabhupada. And concomitantly, I was thinking, okay, I am offering my whole existence to you, Prabhupada. Do what you want. 5 minutes after I got out of the MRI, Madhava had come down from checking and found out that, you know, that the second report proved that I had melanoma cancer, because we wanted a second opinion. So we had a second opinion. The first opinion said I had it at a Clark 4, stage 1 to 4. Second opinion said I had 4 plus. So Madhava came in, met me after I got out of the MRI, and he had kind of a sad look on his face, and I said, what's up? You know, what's the report? He said he went up the stairs or wherever he went to the report, and it was 4 confound the child, his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada.